The little book of Joel, it's on page 1016 in my Bible. No telling where it is in yours. It's in between Hosea and Amos and what is called the minor prophets. Minor only in the length of their prophecy. It's only three chapters long, but mighty in the magnitude of his message. The prophet, Joel himself, the name means Jehovah is God. And we will begin by reading the entire first chapter. The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. Hear this, you elders, and give ear, all you inhabitants of the land. Has anything like this happened in your days, or even in the days of your fathers? Tell your children about it. Let your children tell their children, and their children another generation. Here's what he wants told. This is the launching point of his entire prophecy. And our subject for this morning, verse 4. What the chewing locust left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust left, the crawling locust has eaten. And what the crawling locust left, the consuming locust has eaten. Awake, you drunkards, and weep. And wail, all you drinkers of wine, because of the new wine, for it has been cut off from your mouth. There will be no more. For a nation has come up against my land, strong and without number. His teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he has the fangs of a fierce lion. He has laid waste my vine and ruined my fig tree. He has stripped it bare and thrown it away. Its branches are made white. Lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. The grain offering and the drink offering have been cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests mourn who minister to the Lord. The field is wasted. The land mourns, for the grain is ruined. The new wine is dried up. The oil fails. Be ashamed, you farmers. Wail, you vine dressers, for the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field has perished. The vine has dried up, and the fig tree has withered, the pomegranate tree, the palm tree also, and the apple tree, and all the trees of the field are withered. Surely joy has withered away from the sons of men. Gird yourselves and lament, you priests. Wail, you who minister before the altar. Come lie all night in sackcloth, you who minister to my God. For the grain offering and the drink offering are withheld from the house of your God. Consecrate a fast. Call a sacred assembly. Gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord your God and cry out unto the Lord. Alas for the day. For the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as destruction from the Almighty. Is not the food cut off before our eyes? Joy and gladness from the house of our God. The seed grain shrivels under the clods. Storehouses are in shambles. Barns are broken down, for the grain has withered. How the beasts groan. The herds of the cattle are restless because they have no pasture. Even the flocks of the sheep suffer your punishment. O Lord, to you I cry out. For the fire has devoured the open pastures, and a flame has burned all the trees of the field. The beasts of the field also cry out to you, for the water brooks are dried up, and fire has devoured the open pastures. Of this man, Joel, whose name means Jehovah is God, nothing is known except the name of his father, of whom we know nothing either. All we know is his daddy's name. Don't know a thing in the world about his daddy. There's nothing anywhere written, recorded, to commend him or to validate him or to merit his writings status in this book other than the stamp of the Almighty and the force and the accuracy and significance of his prophecy. The time of his prophecy is very early in the Hebrew nation, when the nation wasn't near as apostate and corrupt and idolatrous and hadn't degenerated nearly to the status that he had by the time we get to the book of Malachi. Before his sins had been multiplied themselves to the depth and magnitude of his later times, which makes his prophecy even that much more remarkable, because he clearly saw what no one would have ever imagined at that time. There was no evidence of it. But to this man, God reserved the honor of predicting some of the most significant events of the age. Notable, the utter ruin of Israel, her restoration and blessedness, the outpouring of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, which ushered in the church age, which nobody had a clue about until Peter stood up and prophesied and interpreted. The spiritual warfare of the church, of which we have just concluded our study in the book of Ephesians. Its triumph, that is, the triumph of the church and its blessedness in Christ, its abiding habitation of God, and the day of the Lord. All of those are in these three chapters. The actual plague of locusts, which he predicts and which the whole prophecy and everything centers around, as horrible and as unbelievable as they were, are but a token of the unspeakably greater spiritual desolation which is brought on by unrepentant wickedness. The prophecies always prophesied, the prophets prophesied, always prophesied in figures. Figures, things with which they were familiar with at the time, but they were really talking about something infinitely greater than that figure, which is a spiritual reality. And that is the desolations brought on by unrepentant wickedness. I want to speak to you this morning under the topic, the ravages of sin. This is the best kept secret in the world. The ravages of sin. The best kept secret in the world. Yet, at the same time, the most prominently displayed and evident one. And that is a wonder indeed. The ravages of sin. And his prophecy opens on this note and he expresses it in verse 4. What the chewing locusts have left, the swarming locust eats. What the swarming locust left, the crawling locust eats. What the crawling locust left, the consuming locust has eaten. In other words, he simply has dramatically and graphically said, everything gone. Nothing is left. The utter desolations and ravages of sin. This is an unknown wonder. The people are called upon to believe something heretofore unseen. Has anybody ever seen anything like this? Have you seen it? Has your daddy seen it? Has your grandpa seen it? Has anyone ever told you about anything like this? Something utterly unknown and seems to be so extreme as to be utterly unbelievable. I mean, we've seen bad times. We've seen bad things, but never anything like this. Not only had these things never been seen by anyone living, but no one had ever even heard of such things. It had never dawned upon them. Our text also tells us it's something to be told to future generations. Your daddy didn't tell you about this, your grandpa didn't tell you about it, but you need to tell your kids. And they need to tell their children. And their children needs to tell the next children what he is about to be said here. After it's passed, that is what he's talking about. You'd think if it happened in this generation, if it happened to us, never happened to anybody before, we never heard about it before, when the next generation would come along, they got the history of it. It's a common thing. We know about that now. That's already happened. And folks would have learned. And they would know this. But no, that's not the way it's going to be. Even though it comes to pass, the next generation will never know about it. They'll have to be told about it. Every generation is going to have to be told this. It's an open secret. It's so evident. It's undeniable. It's unmistakable. But nobody knows it. They'll have to be told it. An absolute essential of the gospel, what we're talking about, the ravages of sin, it is an absolute essential of the gospel because nobody is ever saved until they're lost. And I don't mean just a little bit lost, I mean plumb lost. It's an absolute essential of the gospel. And yet it is received no better in that day than it was in, and that is our day, than it is in Joel's day. People are unprepared to believe such a thing until, and they will, experience something of it themselves. And then, it's too late for them to avoid its sorrows. It will touch everyone. I intended this morning for our responsive reading to read most of the third chapter of Genesis when sin came into the world. The Lord asked the woman, "What is this that thou hast done?" And then he pronounced those awful, terrible, desolate curses that affect all of creation, beginning with the serpent and the woman and the man. Their posterity and how these sorrows would come. The unknown, inexperienced wonder that Joel prophesies. And you remember I told you last Sunday, prophecy, the most profitable part of prophecy and the prophets for us is not what they're predicting, but the moral exhortations and the doctrine that he's giving that is relevant to all people at all times. This is basic foundational doctrine here. The unknown experienced wonder is sin in all its ravages and curses and sorrows and griefs and ruin. Nothing in this earth is less understood, less realized, less comprehended, yet more experienced in all its awful measure than sin. On the other hand, contrarily, it is popularly considered to be something pleasant, to be desired. You heard that old song. Everything I like is either illegal, immoral, or fattening. You've heard that. Maybe you hadn't. People say that and chuckle a little bit about it. In other words, because it's forbidden, everything that's fun and enjoyable is sin, forbidden. It's popularly considered as something pleasant to be desired, to be a thing of wisdom and a prudent choice, the pursuit of the enlightened and the sophisticated. In fact, that's the way it's presented to the woman when she saw that the fruit of the tree was pleasant. See, to be desired to make one wise, make one strong, taste good, pleasant to the eyes, pleasant to the taste. And it makes you more sophisticated. For those who grudgingly admit that it's wrong, it is believed to be a pleasant and profitable thing that makes this present life more worthwhile and fulfilled, even if it must be paid for later. You remember the parable, the story that the Lord gave about, here's this fellow who needed some hired hands, needs some vineyard workers, shorthanded, so he goes out to the marketplace and he finds a bunch of idle people. He says, tell you what, I'll give you a penny for a day's work. And some of them went out on the first day, and so he goes out a little bit later and a bunch of them still there. Next hour, and he says, I'll give you a penny for a day's work. Every hour he goes out there and he offers to pay them a penny for a day's work or for working for today. And so finally, at the end of the day, there's people who only worked 1 hour, and payday came, he gave each man a penny, and those fellows put in 12 hours, said, hey, that ain't fair. Why? Well, we worked all day, and these fellows only worked an hour. Didn't write for them, we get the same thing. The application comes out something like this. Here's a little girl here who became a Christian when she was 7 years old. Six and a half. Here's an old man. He's a sinner all his life, just about everything a sinner could do. He's 89 years old, on his deathbed. He gets saved. Goes to the same heaven she does. Ain't fair. Why? Well, she didn't get to sin. He did. He got all those 90 years of sinning. Had all of this in heaven too. Isn't fair. Now, that's the mentality of people. The idea is she got cheated. But it isn't so. He's the one who got cheated. He's the one who's ruined. But we don't believe that. We believe just the opposite. No. The penalty and the payment for sin is not something that just starts after you die. No. You start paying for it immediately. Sin is a curse, the whole thing. It's not a fun thing now. The truth about it is that sin is its own punishment. Itself. This is what he's talking about. There is indeed a final judgment and banishment of the wicked into the lake of fire. But the ravages and desolations of sin have taken their toll long before that. Sin itself is its own judgment. Now Joel wonderfully wraps his vision of sin's desolations in the figure of the relentless and utter ruin wrought by devouring pests invading the land of Israel and consuming every living plant. What one pest leaves, another takes away, until there's absolutely nothing left in the land to sustain life. Jehovah speaks in the first person through the mouth of the prophet of these locusts as an alien army, a fierce, innumerable, invincible host invading his land and utterly laying it waste. Look at verse 6 and 7. Here is God speaking. This is quite often you'll find this happen in the prophet. Suddenly, God speaks in the first person. The prophet's still writing, the prophet's speaking, but it's God speaking directly. It isn't Joel. This is God. A nation has come up against my land. Whose land is it? It isn't Joel's, it's God's land. My land. Strong without number. He says this nation, what did he talk about? He's talking about those locusts. Her teeth, his teeth is the teeth of a lion. He has the fangs of a fierce lion. He has laid waste my vine, ruined my fig tree. He has stripped it bare and thrown it down. Its branches are made white. All of these are figures that we must see interpreted. I want us to consider sin and its ravages and three progressing mentalities this morning. Help us a little bit to understand the way the prophets write and the figures they use. It'll also help us a little bit to understand our own time and the way in which we live and the way that it is treated even by poorly informed Christendom. Then we will understand something about what is really happening. The ravages of sin under the old covenant mentality. Two of the major differences between the old covenant, that is Israel, and the arrangement that they had with the Lord at that time that God made with them, and the new covenant, that is that which was brought and bought through the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ and under which we live now, and the arrangement and dispensation under which we live with God. Two of the big differences in that was God dealt with them as a group, as a society, as a state. He didn't deal with them so much individually as a group. What one person sinned, but on the whole nation. One person righteousness imputed to the whole nation. He dealt with everybody according as a covenant group. In the New Testament, the New Covenant, he deals with us personally, individually. He doesn't say that the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth set on edge. No, what your daddy did doesn't have a thing in the world to do with the way God deals with you. It's every man for himself before God. The soul that sinneth it shall die. The soul of the Father, the soul of the Son, they're separate individuals. That's one of the keystones. Another is the fact that old covenant blessings were material blessings. Food, shelter, clothing, those things that have to do with our personal mundane life. And so they are presented in those figures. The old covenant was made with its blessings or its curses related to the people's physical existence. The temporal prosperity and peace of their nation. This is graphically laid out in Deuteronomy chapter 28, and I'll read a few of those passages for you to illustrate that. If you'll turn with me to that passage, Deuteronomy chapter 28. I don't think I'm going to get through this sermon this morning. Going too slow. Unless y'all can listen a whole lot faster than you've been to it. Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 1 through 8. Now it shall come to pass. This is how the covenant works, the old covenant. If you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. That's what the Jews are still looking for. They won't be sitting on top of the pile. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, and because you obey the voice of the Lord your God, you're going to be big, powerful politically, because you obey God's voice. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, that's your kids, and produce of your ground, that's your crops. And the increase of your herd, that's your cattle, your calves, your kids. The increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flocks. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. The Lord will command a blessing on you and in your storehouses and in all to which you set your hand, and He will bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. And we could go on and on, but it's more repetition of the same sort of thing. On the other hand, verse 15. But it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, you sin, to observe carefully His commandments and His statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city. Cursed shall you be in the country. That's the reason we're short of gasoline right now and oil. Everybody's running from the city to the country and the country to the city to get away from the curse, and the curse still catches them. You can't run fast enough to get away from it. You can't build enough highways. They're still running from it. They can't find any peace or comfort anywhere. They're still running. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body, your children, the produce of your land, your crops, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out. And the Lord will send on you cursing, confusion, and rebuke, and all that you set your hand to do until you are destroyed. And until you perish quickly because of the wickedness of your doings in which you have forsaken me. Now this is the sort of thing that Joel is seeing. The Lord will make the plague cling to you until it has consumed you from the land which you are going to possess. The Lord will strike you with consumption, with fever, with inflammation, with severe burning fever, with a sword, with scorching, and with mildew, and you shall perish, and they shall pursue you until you perish. And your heavens which are over your head shall be bronze, and the earth which is under you shall be iron. And the Lord will change the land, rain of your land, to powder, dry as dust. From the heaven it shall come down on you until you're destroyed. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them, and you shall become troublesome to all kingdoms of the earth, and your carcasses shall be food for all the birds of the air and beasts of the earth, until, and no one shall frighten them away. And it goes on. These physical types, and this is what they are, types of new covenant spiritual realities are eminently suited to a nation that has no insurance of any kind. You think about that a little bit now. There's no welfare programs. I mean, if you had a Brother Denny spoke about this not too long ago, something about a widow. Women didn't want any jobs for women. A woman depended upon her husband. Her husband gone. She depended upon her children. There was no welfare. There was nothing. There was no provision. She was desolate. The judge didn't help her. She was going to starve. She was going to die. No welfare. No welfare programs. No crop supports. Nowadays, you know, I understand sweet potato crop pretty bad this year. And these past 3 years, hadn't been farmed in 3 years. Farmers gone bankrupt, busted. crying out to Washington to give some support. Nothing like that. No crop supports. No disaster relief. Hurricane, tornado, earthquake hits. You don't sit on your hands and cry for the government to do that. What? Nothing. There was nothing. These people are solely dependent on the mercies of their God. Isn't that terrible? Farmers depending upon rain from heaven to make a crop grow, and the fact that the bug's not going to eat it up. Got to depend on God to make a crop. And no government help. Terrible, terrible. And that's exactly how God wants us to live. You see how hostile and alien that is to the modern mind today? What are these two peckerwoods trying to get the president? What they're yapping at each other about? About which one is going to give the other, not do the other on giving government goodies, which is money they pick out of your pocket and give you back some of it. I'm talking about the ravages of sin. Dependent solely upon the mercies of their God, and that is precisely how God intended his people to live. You know that there was a time in this nation, in the Christian, conservative, reformed Christian church, if anybody found out you had insurance of any kind, you'd get kicked out of church for unbelief. That's been a long time ago. What does the Bible say? The just shall walk by faith. Now I understand that the way the system is set up, you've got to live that way. The only way you can, if you don't have any medical insurance, you will pay four or five times as much as the fellow who got the insurance. They've got two ways to bill from a hospital. I get these bills and I find out what they're going to do. $4,000 for outpatient. Excuse me just a minute. I want to chase a rabbit just a moment. $4,000 my wife for an outpatient. She never even had a room or a hospital bed or anything. Just up there for a few hours and went home. $4,000. Not even over. She even needed admitted to the hospital. Well, when I finally got the settlement from the Medicare people, it showed nearly $3,000 worth of adjustments before they paid a little over $1,000. That's all they paid. Why? They got the leverage. Well, if you don't have the leverage, you don't have an insurance, you know how much you're going to pay? You're going to pay $4,000. Isn't justice wonderful? Isn't that kind? Isn't that compassionate? They call that cost shifting. Any other legal term is stealing. Robbery, fraud. But that's it. Excuse me, I'm through with chasing that rabbit now. You see, the ravages of sin, what it does to a society and what it does to a people. But here is an agrarian economy. It's not built upon banking or financing or industry, marketing, trading, or any of the hundreds of other service industries. Lots of ways to make a living out today. But they only had one at that time. I just farming. That's all. The ravages of sin are all taken out on the crops, the plants, the trees, everything that they cultivated and depended upon for livelihood, living stuff, farming. The locusts and worms took everything. They left absolutely nothing. They even stripped the trees of their bark and the living cambium to where there was nothing left but the white underlayment of the dead wood. He pictures the fig trees and the vines like that. They literally did that. Those bugs went in and ate everything that was alive. Such a vivid picture. Life is gone, and the means to regenerate it is also gone. The seeds under the clods are dried up. There's not any crop. Not going to be any crop. Ruin and death is Tophel. He's picturing the ravages of sin. The ravages of sin in today's world viewed with old covenant mentality. It is a lamentable fact and a testimony to the carnality of the overwhelming bulk of Christendom that old covenant mentality still prevails in respect to sin and ungodliness. These are seen more clearly to affect our corporate, mundane, worldly existence like they did in the old covenant. Society as a whole, rather than our personal spiritual lives. When we mourn about sin, when the wailing is done about the wickedness in the nation, we point to how it's affected the state and its economy and society. And forget about what it's doing to our souls. Missed it. It is absolutely true that sin corrupts and destroys societies, industry, education, homes, families, ethics, just as the pests, one after another, consumed everything that had life in it, in Joel's vision. So does this wicked, insatiable beast of sin eat up a nation, its civil order and its government. Unrighteousness immediately follows right upon the heels of ungodliness. You understand what I said? Unrighteousness follows immediately upon the heels of ungodliness. You see, well, those two are very closely related, but they're not the same. Ungodliness is simply no God. Unrighteousness is immorality, God or no God. Unrighteousness. If no God, there's not going to be any righteousness. Unrighteousness follows immediately upon the heels of ungodliness. And it's a curse and a destroying plague to any nation and any society. It destroys marriage, families, robs children of their childhood, and leaves them yet children when they grow up. They still longing to be a child because they weren't permitted to be a child when they were a child, and they never become grown. Robs children of their discipline. What a wicked, horrible, wretched, murderous thing it is when children were robbed of the discipline of their parents. The rod taken out of their hands robs them of their reverence and submission without which no people can survive and live. In the name of education, sin has plunged the whole of society into abysmal darkness. It vaunts, I'm talking about this sin, in the name of education, vaunts and bloats itself and is content with nothing less than absolute sway over every mind in the country. Mind you, I'm not preaching against education. I'm talking about this darkness, this sin, this ungodliness that calls itself under the name of education. Isn't knowledge that ruined us and ignorance to help us. It lies and ungodliness. Wherever such worldly sophistication proliferates, it is immediately accompanied with spiritual desolation. and rot of the soul. I don't read sound off in the paper much. In fact, I don't read very much in the paper at all. I don't know why I subscribe to that thing. I'm just waiting for the subscription to get over with where I won't have to throw away the paper every morning. But I read one the other day. Just caught my eye. Just happened to be running across there. And this fellow said, and I won't go into detail how he made his point, but he made his point is you find those states and those areas in the United States where poverty and ignorance was most prevalent are the identical areas in which fundamental Christianity is most prevalent. You get it? You get it? The reason they are poor and ignorant is because they believe the Bible, they believe God. The conversely true of that, of course, would be those places where it's most prosperous and well informed are those people, those places where Christianity and God is unknown. Very evident. Well, people will take two things and make one the cause and the other effect when really the cause is the effect and the effect is the cause. People who know God, people who believe God, people who walk with God, are not greedy beasts trying to outdo the next fellow. They're not following the world. They're not marching to the beat of the drummer. You know what poverty is? Poverty of the soul. Poverty of the heart. They got their values all mixed up. But that's the word that sounded out. Sin destroys industry. It corrupts labor and management roles. Make greedy, heartless tyrants of employers. Lazy, gold-bricking, careless, unprofitable drones of employees. It makes good government impossible. Kings become madmen or spoiled children, greedily seizing anything that meets their fancies. Elections are decided upon the most foolish and irrational and stupid of issues. They become silly bidding contests, and people idiotic enough to elect the biggest liar and the slickest fraud. Now that's the brutal facts about the matter, folks. So you should not be dismayed and wondering about what's happening. Judgment and justice are only empty, meaningless symbols among a people who have forgotten God and His law. Values and ethics are created out of thin air, whatever happens to be the vogue or fad of the day. Every political entity is run by corruption and bribes. It isn't just Rapides Parish or Grant Parish. It's everywhere. Every political entity. Sin blinds the system to justice. People may temporarily have money in their pockets, but it's worthless because it won't buy anything of value. They may exert little sweat and little physical strain, but labor more and rest not at all. They may have time to do what they please, but nothing yields any life, peace, or contentment. They pine away desperately, dropping one toy and reaching for another, and wondering why. All of this prosperity, people got more money than have ever, they're going deeper in debt. Can't buy enough. Art loses its beauty and order and reason. Music is a mad, clanging, howling, evil discord. Poetry and song sinks into profanity, cursing, murderous insanity. Songs, painting and sculpture, mirror perversion, filth, disorder, and irrationality. The more graphic murder, violence, horror, and filth is displayed in entertainment, the more it is lusted after. Guns and knives, the cause of the killing and the murder? No! It is a preoccupation of children with guns and knives. What for? To kill with? That's what they see all the time. We've always had guns and knives. It's sin and the loss of reality that's made a nation of murderers from their birth all the way through. The military loses its morale. We're talking about sin's curse on a corporate society. There's nothing noble, Brother Denny, nothing noble left in the nation to love and sacrifice for. Why should the military give their lives for a sin, for a nation rotting under the cynicism like this one is, or any other? It becomes mercenary, flaccid, and ineffective. The worms of sin eat everything. Nothing is left, and the whole thing crumbles from within. It's no small part of this darkness and loss itself that the religious right, so-called Christian activism, has it spending its energies and resources loudly and fervently attempting to correct this rot and ruin of the nation by harping on various aspects of these corporate curses and trying to correct them by political action, media blitzes, economic boycotts, I don't know how much more I can boycott the movies and Disney World than I am now. I ain't going to none of them. Legislation, lawsuits, and generally turning the church into a forum to bring our nation back to God. Missed and lost in this whole mad frenzy is a simple fact that this corporate societal ruin is only the consequence and inevitable, unavoidable outworking of the ruinous ravages of sin in people, in their individual souls. Their souls and their souls of a single person. That's where he has to center. And that's what the gospel centers on. And this is the main part of our message, and I done wore you out. The ravages of sin in the soul. New covenant, spiritual realities. What one bug didn't eat, the next one does. What he didn't eat, the next one does. What he didn't eat, the next one does, until there's nothing left in the human soul. That's where the real problem lies. Some rock bottom foundational facts. God is wise, God is good, God is absolutely perfect in wisdom and love and kindness. Is that so? Is that so? Yes! He can't say anything wrong, he can't do anything wrong. Everything is good. His commandments, his law, his will, his instructions, his established way communicated to his people are not therefore designed to restrict life and joy and fulfillment, but to facilitate life in its perfect fullness. Jesus' words, "I am come that they may have life and life more abundantly." He's our maker, our creator. Indeed, he is our source. Nothing makes more sense than to believe that he knows and wills best for us. That's explicit in the garden. He put a garden there. What did he plant? What did he build? Everything, not for himself, but for the man. Everything that could be blessed and of any good thing for the man, he made it to grow there and give it to him. Says, you're help yourself. Just have one stipulation. I'm God. I'm the creator. You're the man. You're not wise enough to run your own life. I am. Listen to me. To know him and obey him is life. His law is commandments. They cannot give life, but they do safeguard it. To listen to the serpent, to reject and disobey God is death. Absolutely loss of everything. Moral and spiritual ruin and desolation. Sin is nothing other than the rejection of God. Nothing less. Can't be more. Rejection of God and God's law does not wait on a final judgment. It's immediate judgment and desolation itself. It's systematically and relentlessly, I'm talking about sin, systematically and relentlessly, like the locust, eats away our lives. It robs us of life. The longer we linger in it, the more we mess with it, the more we give into it, the more it eats up. And dear friends, when a locust has eaten something, you don't get that back. It's gone. When you eat the bark, the cambium off of a tree, that tree's dead. You're not going to get any figs off it. You're not going to get grapes off of that vine. It's gone. It's dead. There's nothing there. It's gone. What worm? One worm does not eat, the other one does until nothing's left. These awful desolations are graphically cataloged in Romans 1, 18 through 32. I'm not going to read these to you. We don't have enough time. Isaiah 59, 2 through 15. It would have been enough this morning for me to stand up and read those two passages and sit down. It's all said there. We mourn sore like doves. We look for light, but behold obscurity. There's nothing left. Judgment is falling in the street. Brother Denny said it this morning. There's none righteous. No, not one. All have fallen. But in Romans, you have a wonderful progression, systematic progression of it. First, there's a suppression of truth. The world is full of truth. The creation shouts truth from one end of it to the other in all of God's creation. You can't hide from it. There's no language, there's no tongue that it isn't testified. From the rising of the sun to the going down. And everywhere man looks, he pulls his hands out over his face. He still can't deny his own body. He looks inside and he sees truth. It's everywhere. And he pushes it back. He suppresses that at the beginning. Men know it, but sin suppresses it. Pushes it out of their thoughts. Unable at first to get rid of the knowledge of God, sin corrupts it and reduces God to a corrupt man. Then four-footed beasts, crawling things. Pride, the ark sin, vaunts and puffs up men, gives them the illusion of being wise while they're really becoming more and more stupid fools. Their minds are filled with more emptiness, vanities, stupidity, and nothingness. I am a reader, have been all my life. I love to read. I love to read books. Reading is taunted, or rather vaunted. And I heartily recommend it. Good books if you can find some. But I have a pastor and his wife who told me several years ago, said, my wife and I, for years, Thursday, we would go down to the library early in the morning, spend almost all day at the library reading. Just various things, picking up books out of the library and reading. Spent the whole day pretty well in the library. We'd been doing that for a number of weeks until finally both of us admitted the same thing. We didn't know why it was, but when we left the library, it seemed like, although when we went there the sun was shining and we were cheerful, we just had a Wednesday night worship service and the Lord was on our mind, When we left there in the afternoon and the evening, it seemed like a veil of darkness and gloom and deadness was over us. Finally dawned on them, where'd they get it? They got it in the library, where there ought to be light. I could preach on that. I'm just mentioning that. Light, that's darkness. Sin corrupts him. Professing themselves to be wise, they really become more and more stupid fools, and their mind filled with emptiness and vanity, darkness, stupidities, and nothing. What's done it? Sin. God gives them over to them after their mind is gone to the corrupting lust of their bodies. You see the progression? No truth. No God. Turning, professing ourselves wise, we become fools. Their minds are gone. Now the bodies too. Given over the corrupting lust of their hearts, they're dishonoring, they're abusing their bodies among themselves. Society becomes a pack of wild dogs, preying on each other, robbing, killing, raping, consuming one another. Because sin is never satisfied, normal lusts give way to perverted ones. Men lose manhood, try to be women. Women lose their femininity, try to be men. Both now helpless victims of demons, and the brief respites they get from illicit drugs and sex acts. They give themselves over to unspeakably vile and filthy acts, and you wouldn't believe it if I told you some of them this morning. I can't do it. They're too filthy to speak of. Romans 1:27 tells us this, which underscores my message for this morning. Let me quote it to you. Don't forget it. Receiving in themselves, in their very bodies. Now, the penalty of their error, which was due unto them. Sin is taking its penalty out on your very body, your mind, and your life. And Romans tells us, because they hate the knowledge and consciousness of God, God relieves them even of that blessedness. I don't think we have ever considered this. How blessed it is, even for the sinner. And knowing the fact that he's going to have to face a just judge and a God, and a just God is going to judge him. Nevertheless, it still makes some sense and reality of existence. But when God is gone out of our minds and there's no God in the universe, what is there? What am I? I'm not even a bug, a locust, or a worm. I have no significance whatsoever. Life is not real. It's nothing. There's nothing left. It's all been eaten up. Without God, life. And the whole universe becomes utterly meaningless. That's what you find now in that utter desolation in existential literature. Find plenty of that down at the dark holes they call the library. Everything is empty and worthless. Nothing is left but darkness, depression, joylessness, sorrow, restlessness, fear, guilt, and condemnation, with no remedy and no hope. Have a wave of that sweep over your soul. Yet this is what's left. After the ravages of sin, the Bible puts it like this in the first Psalm in verse 4. What are we? Chaff, aimlessly blown about by the wind. Jude puts it this way in verses 12 and 13. Trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots, raging waves of the sin. People, this is all they are. forming out their own shame, wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. And we've run through this far too fast to reflect upon it. And I wouldn't expect us to be able, even at this point, but I must say it, but I'm about to close.